This is Tierra Dahl with Municipal Sustainability and Energy Forum, and today we have a panel discussing co-ops, CCAs, and local power supply exemptions as a legal structure for microgrids. Our panel today is Baird Brown with Eco in Law, Larissa Dobriansky with General Microgrids, and Kleena Robb with Thompson McMullen. All three are attorneys. So, Baird, why don't you go ahead and start us out here, and we'll follow up with Larissa and then Kleena.
Sure. Let me start with what's at stake here. Probably all of us have read somebody's version of deep decarbonization pathways or the drawdown project or other. There's a proliferation of research on what it's going to take to keep our aggregate temperature change, which we're lucky, to 1.5 degrees, having already consumed about 1 degree of that. And it certainly includes moving rapidly to deploy renewable energy and displace coal, gas, you know, all fossil fuels as promptly as we can. And I'm persuaded that letting utilities do that is not probably, it's not the wrong way, but it's not enough of a way. It's way beyond what utilities are currently investing in, and in a lot of states, it's not even up to the utilities anymore to invest in generation. And what we really need is a democratization of the grid, and we need to have customers and communities taking action to take over their own energy destiny and installing or having folks install for them the new generation. And of course, in a lot of places, either because of fires in California or because of superstorms on the East Coast, there's a lot of concern with resilience and how to have local microgrids that allow folks to keep relying on electricity even when the grid is down, as it has been more frequently. So for lots of reasons, local investment, either by customers or by communities, is important. And that's going on both in places like California, where community choice aggregation is actually in the law. But here in Philadelphia, the city of Philadelphia has recently signed up an 80-megawatt solar project in a county about 50 miles west of here that will take up about 20% of its aggregate electric purchases. So lots of people are moving in large and small ways. And that runs up against a whole set of legal barriers, and in particular, it runs up against just the definition of a utility and the fact that we've been we're still dealing with 100-year-old utility regulation and laws that were written when we decided that electricity was a monopoly, a natural monopoly. And of course, there's different technology now, and even when we decided that, a lot of people were self-generating. That really only died out in the 50s for a lot of industrial users. So we're trying now to deal with the fact that in many states, depending on how utility is defined, and it may be defined with relation to the shift to the ownership of generation or the ownership of wires or to sales of electricity. There's a lot of small variations that can result in either you simply not being allowed to do anything at all, or if you did do anything at all, you'd be subject to full regulation as a utility, which would generally sink any kind of ordinary size project that we'd be thinking about at the grid edge. So what we're trying to do is get past, get around those definitions for now, and hopefully change them in the future. There are all kinds of exceptions that are written into those utility statutes, and you really have to look on a case-by-case basis in every state to see what they might be. A lot of states have landlord exceptions. That is to say, a landlord can redistribute power to its tenants, but oftentimes that's premised on the idea that they in turn are buying from the utility and they have to pass through the utility's price. So again, you have to look at those carefully. Sometimes there's a similar exception with regard to homeowners associations acting on behalf of an entire community that has a formal homeowners association. There are a lot of states where there's some local area that is exempted. In New York, the best one from my point of view is where they've just said any adjacent, and by that they didn't mean literally touching, they just meant anybody that's in the near vicinity of a qualified facility can buy power from it. California, on the other hand, has a rule that you can cross one property line but no state road. So that's a very limiting rule, and it discouraged Berkeley, for example, from doing a microgrid, although I think there might have been a better way if they had thought about it. A lot of the statutes are written that a utility is an entity that holds itself out to serve the public, and different states have interpreted that differently, but in a lot of places the case law is such that if you serve eight people and you're not soliciting other people to join in, as an example, you're probably not a utility. And then different utilities take more or less hostile views of that. So if you're a small organization that's trying to set up a 15-member community with solar and batteries to serve the entire community, the fact that you're not selling to anybody outside the boundaries of the community may not be of much benefit if the utility is threatening to sue you within an inch of your life if you try to do that, and you can't really afford to take them on. One of the things that works some places and does work in California is to form an electric cooperative. And there's no reason why you can't form an electric cooperative for four city blocks. You know, it doesn't have to be large. It doesn't have to be, you know, turn itself into an entire municipal entity or any such thing. And I gather that in the crisis back in early 2000s around Enron, a lot of industrial users did exactly that in California. Of course, there's community choice aggregation, and I think it's about eight jurisdictions now around the country that have it. Although that's designed for a municipality to serve all of its citizens and not so much designed directly to allow setting up, say, microgrids or smaller segments of the community. Although, given that they have the ability to purchase from whoever they want to purchase from at wholesale, if somebody, they can encourage microgrids by allowing, you know, by purchasing excess output from them. Some places I think it's about 23 states now that has some form of retail choice, which means that anybody can sell electricity if they get a license. And that means that you bill the electricity through the utility and you use the utility's wires. To do that with a microgrid, you can just form a local load-serving entity under those rules, and we've done that, for example, in New York to successfully have a community solar market. So those are the principal exemptions. So you'll probably hear more from Larissa and Fiona. And the last thing I would say is, it's really high time to stop playing this sort of runaround game. And to me, what we really need is something more like an energy bill of rights. Basically, every customer has the right to generate and manage energy behind its meter, to purchase clean energy from local providers through its own or the provider's distribution system, to purchase energy through local group or community arrangements, and to have prompt access to all the information gathered by public utilities so it knows about itself, about its own usage, so it knows how to plan for for its own generation, and then grid access in case it has something to sell back. And by that, I don't mean net metering, but there's often a disconnect between the demand response rules and distributed generation rules that makes it hard for you to both respond by consuming less, and then as you ramp your generator up, eventually go to a net export position. That can be hard to do in a lot of states and a lot of the RTOs. So with that, I'll stop and turn it over.
Okay, I just noticed that Craig Lewis has joined us. He is also on the panel. So Craig, I'll introduce you at the end here. Uh-oh, that was pretty noisy. All right, so Larissa, do you want to go ahead and add to this conversation?
Sure. I heartily agree with the stage that Baird set, the things he went over. Let me see. I've got my own stuff I'll address, but let me just segue out of what he had to say. The point, totally agree. I mean, it should be obvious, actually, to everybody. I'm talking stakeholders, United States, and this whole, as you said, Baird game, the targets here, the mandate, they really exceed the capability of the utility and also the legal limitations on the amount of risk that a utility can take. And also this public interest. And that's where I think we really need to exploit this to the extent possible, because I am witnessing now this year more than, I guess, is kind of under the surface, but now things are developing more and more in terms of the utility strategies to not really act in the public's interest and be customer-oriented, but to extend their natural monopoly. And I'm seeing huge strategies in terms of, we're talking about communities here, but whether it's D.C. and Ohio, others, there is a big strategy afoot in terms of what they call, like Pepco, Exelon, connected communities. But what this is turning out to mean is an extension of ownership and operation by utilities of the enabling infrastructure. So they would own the batteries, front and behind the meter, communications infrastructure, control infrastructure. And in terms of, like, just the other day, another in the series of webinars and conferences, SEPA, illustrations over and over again how the utilities are coming in, and not with a balanced approach, but this extension of ownership and operation. And I totally agree with what Baird said. I mean, if this is going to be taken in an exclusory way, it sure would limit the potential we have in terms of the enabling technology that is now moving apace. So taking everything that Baird said in the context, I mean, we have now distributed resources are proliferating. Digitalization is moving rapidly, distributed intelligence, data analytics, Internet of Things, beneficial electrification. The technologies, I think, are way out ahead, and it's the gap is growing between the regulatory drawdown, lag, and the technologies and the potential we can tap into. And there just are real limits all the way around in terms of what the utilities can do. In terms of the illustrations like that I hear all the time in these SEPA and other forums, it just becomes so clear also the expertise that they do not have. And yet what they are doing in terms of this ownership and operation strategy is to just get equipment. That's how they're working in terms of partnerships, not in terms of really who can assume the risk best and manage it, who really has the expertise to be able to move apace and in a more sophisticated way. Because I hear, for the most part, the type of utility partnerships within communities, and they are really, I'd have to put them, you know, in the just preliminary. I mean, there are exceptions here. There's some very excellent microgrid projects I'd have to name, like, for example, Encore, SMUD, but there's a lot going out on here where it is just this staging for ownership and operation. So I think, you know, from the public interest standpoint, I'm hoping that the regulators, the commissions, can become more proactive. And also in this definition of utility here, like Baird said, wide interpretations. There are jurisdictions, I forgot whether it's Idaho or Iowa, sometime back had to examine in terms of a solar PV, you know, vendors developing facilities and selling, whether their activities would constitute, you know, come within the definition of utility, and they develop certain criteria. I think this is another open area for us to try to really get change, because a lot of us are working on microgrids as a service, and there just are so many distinguishing characteristics, and they will become more distinguishing as microgrids evolve to differentiate microgrids from the characteristics of utilities, and particularly facing competition, the risks, but also in terms of the types of services that go well beyond, you know, distributing a commodity and the way in which utility functions. So I do see that as, you know, ripe for new interpretation and reinforcement, you know, throughout the United States the best we can. Also, CCA, others can be looking at what California is doing. California is changing this in terms of opening opportunities for microgrids, because, you know, we've had, I forgot, you know, part of a group, Sierra, Goldsmith, you know, the fellow that goes over the regional approaches, now a lot of institutionalization and reworking in
Golding?
California CCA. Yes, right. And how to
band
together in governance structures that are empowering them more, and looking just to the wholesale, but to the local in terms of they're running their diversification portfolio management and what they will invest in. So not just geared, I think everybody else is geared to the wholesale, but very significant changes in California along those lines. Now, in terms of some of the areas that, like, I've been working in, but the regulatory, I mean, we've really got a battle there, and I'll take that into my illustrations. Well, some good things came out a while back on public purpose in terms of a carve-out for, acceleration of microgrids and exemptions under the current regulatory regime. But this, from what I've seen, this doesn't seem to be getting much anywhere. A big leader on this was Maryland. They mapped out two paths, one to start immediately with utilities, public purpose, and utilization of microgrids. So far, that has totally failed. A key thing, though, is political leadership. The political leadership has changed in the state of Maryland, and I think it would have moved on had, you know, Hogan not been elected governor. But instead, it came to a standstill, and we've witnessed, you know, the commissions have rejected proposals by Baltimore Gas and Electric and Pepco. But that still remains something that might be evolved in other localities or with the appropriate political leadership. Another big area is in the economic development. Now here, Peridot Energy, now this is something that Shalom, I don't know if he's on the call today, but has had a lot of experience because energy improvement districts, you know, industrial hubs, economic development zones, you know, you've had Sierra Opportunity Zones, but there really is a need for this kind of subsidization, which takes a more holistic approach to, you know, community land use development, redevelopment, even in also rehabilitation areas, because I've heard over and over in so many forums, you listen to how parties are going about, you know, project by project developing, and it really is, there isn't any one-stop shop or holistic approach, and with the appropriate incentives and subsidization. I see California as very ripe for doing more here. I think California is moving along a great track in terms of its whole approach to accelerating advanced energy communities. But this type of institutionalization and subsidization, I think, is very needed. Now, in the regulatory area, we've had different approaches for kind of regulation light for microgrids, but so far I really haven't seen any great headway. Most recently, I and Baird's colleague Chris, we participated in this DC METSIS proceeding, and the Department of Energy and Environment there was really pushing for some type of regulation light approach. The only thing is that I don't think it was kind of the best case that could be put forward because they really weren't trying to justify the reason for carving out regulation light. And this isn't a jurisdiction where, still as of now, despite a lot of different proceedings, that METSIS alone was like 10-11 months. They are of the mind that you cross public ways, you impose the full gamut of utility regulation, which is, of course, absurd, as Baird said, nonsensical. That just guts everything. But on the other hand, I think you need support in terms of the value that microgrids can provide. I mean, the reason for the public purpose exemption was because of the value microgrids can provide to resiliency, and because there have been great cases showing that Sandy, other major storms, where were the areas that withstood them? They were the centers with the Princeton, New York University, et cetera, the ones with the microgrids. So, but some kind of like a basis justification has to be provided to support, in my view, regulation light. Also, D.C. and other areas are considering this. Some type of legislation outside of the utility world that could deal with, I'm not sure what's happening here, but could deal with coordination and management of distributed energy resources, microgrids, within community land use development, redevelopment. In D.C., it has been mainly geared so far to override utilities, but they have a dual authority legislation, and we're trying to expand it to really better empower communities to get an equal seat at the table vis-a-vis utilities, to have a voice and say on what's being developed within the community itself, and not just have this run through the prism of utility regulation, the electricity sector. And this I see as having great potential. And I think the more that the distributed resources proliferate, microgrids continue to develop a track record on their workability, responsibility, accountability, and the value that they're bringing, I mean, there's going to have to be something here to put the community in its own right at the table vis-a-vis the utility sector, and some harmonization between utility, community resource planning, development processes, and, you know, along the lines that Baird was saying, some kind of really not Bill of Rights, for the customer, but the customer also being including the community and what the community as a whole in terms of their rights vis-a-vis the utility and harmonization processes. Because unless these resource planning and development processes between the utility and the community can be better harmonized through like master planning and better institutionalization here, and also the interrelationship of the different tools. Utilities have a lot of support tools and methods, but also the communities can tap into and are tapping into different types of tools and methods, and these have to be harmonized, and it could be for the greater good, and certainly within the context of digitalization, electrification, I think this is a must. And this will entail, in my view, the need for new governance structures, incentives within communities. And going back to what I said, you know, whether it's like towards micro-municipalization allowed, and this would be really alleviating considerably the kind of requirements presently for municipalization, a different approach that would be more from the community side of the picture to complement economic growth and development, rehabilitation, et cetera, and to help also advance net zero goals. I mean, more and more of this is proliferating in terms of mandates across the country, and but we need the institutionalization, the complement, I believe, from the community side. And here, too, we took up also as part of this reinstitutionalization, we took this up, and we're going to keep pounding in D.C. Generally, under present legacy laws, you have, of course, the definition of the utility, also electricity supply, you know, retailer supply, services providers. And we found in this METSIS proceeding, the microgrid does not, you know, developer, energy services provider does not fit at all comfortably within either of the definitions within in the D.C. statute. And so it was proposed developing a new classification, microgrid integrated energy services provider, and to distinguish the kind of services there from what electricity supply service provider does and in terms of wholesale, retail services, and also, of course, from the utility itself. And we think this is an integral ingredient as well. And like to see in the energy efficiency area as part of this institutionalization, reinstitutionalization, moving from the building scale to the community scale, particularly within an Internet of Things-enabled framework in terms of clean energy, energy efficiency standards for land use planning and development. And then another area that I think is rich, and I was hoping for a greater collaboration, but I think it's evolving, is the platform, developing local energy marketplaces to really ultimately, you know, benefit customers, retailers, and particularly enable, you know, community residents, commercial, small commercial entities to buy and sell locally produced energy. And here, I think, again, this has a lot of potential, and from different things going on, particularly New York City, the Brooklyn area, they took surveys, and something that hit me was that the citizens were very much interested in being able to see benefits, results that redound to them directly. They said, well, you know, a lot of them said that they had contribute, you know, renewable portfolio standards, but they don't get to see the benefits go back to their own community place. And so they really would like to develop these local energy marketplaces to be able to advance their own community economic growth and development. And, of course, blockchain technologies are coming in that could enable this. And here, and speaking of innovative platforms, I'm talking in a broad sense. You have utilities that are beginning to evaluate and trying to put in place these type of marketplace platforms. Of course, that was the centerpiece in terms of New York REV, where the utility distribution companies would set up these you know, distributed service platforms. But and like Avista out on the West Coast, in terms of Oregon and also Washington State, they're looking at this. And I'm not looking at this just from the utility standpoint. I think that would be invaluable to set up these platforms within the utility. But the microgrid, in terms of its infrastructure, and particularly in the community context, could really be an infrastructure as a service platform itself. And I think we should strive to bring down the regulatory barriers to also develop these kind of platforms within the Internet of Things-enabled framework within communities themselves. So those are some of the things that I'm seeing. You know, very, very early nascent stages, but I think there's hope. The last comment would be, I am seeing dangerous signs, big red flags in terms of steps that particularly Southern Company, Exelon have been taking, and they have a lot of money, and again, to extend the ownership and operation. So on the microgrid side, I think we need more consolidation and coordination to come at this with a more unified voice. So with that, pass the baton.
All right. Kleena? And one other thing. Okay, no, go ahead, Kleena, with Thompson McMullen.
Sure. Yeah, and I can just echo what the first two speakers have said, Bear and Larissa. We're seeing that in Virginia. That's where I look at the struggles with microgrids. The
you said Virginia, right?
Virginia, yep.
Yeah, I live here, Well, they may change now that even though I'm a Republican, things may change now that we've got a Democratic legislature. But yeah, it's been totally Neanderthal.
Yeah, the you know, so I think someone. Or the phrase that was coming to my mind based on the previous discussion was, you know, can we change the hearts and minds of the legislature and the regulators? We have a State Corporation Commission, that's our, basically our public utility commission. They've had two commissioners on there for a long while, a newer commissioner on there for a year, and they have not been. I work a lot with customers and with competitive suppliers, and the regulators have not been as helpful as we would hope in terms of letting customers have options beyond the utility options. So one of the speculations I've heard, our brand new commissioner who was filling out a term, and she's up for being reappointed this January. The scuttlebutt I've heard is that since she was appointed by the Republican legislator, the Democrats might decide, based on past history, that they don't want to renew her or appoint her for a full term because, you know, the Republicans are mean to them, so the Democrats therefore can be mean to a Republican appointee. So there's speculation that she would come out. So that would put and the notion is if with a Democratic legislator, maybe you'll get a more environmentally friendly commissioner. And then the other twist I've heard is that, well, you know, why do we have to have three commissioners? Why can't we have five? And so the notion is if that comes to pass, you might be able to appoint three environmentally friendly commissioners, in which case the you know, you might get some different rulings out of the State Corporation Commission. So that's all speculation. I'm not on the inside track for any of that. It's just some scuttlebutt I've heard, you know, versus changes on the regulatory front. Now, that's not going to be sufficient if the laws remain as restrictive as they are. So, you know, we've got, you know, laws on the books, 56.589 for muni and state aggregation, which look great, except that they say, oh, by the way, this muni and state aggregation is subject to our competitive supply laws under 56.577, and those are restrictive. So, you know, they take with one hand and or give with one hand and take with the other. So you could have some fairly simple fixes to state law that would open up muni and state aggregation, you know, give localities more choice in going down the lines for microgrids. You know, I've been to recent presentations about microgrids in Virginia, which I was wondering, you know, is that a bit of an oxymoron? You know, so long as you do stuff behind the meter, you know, it was a developer who worked with the utility, Dominion, and, you know, like Baird was saying, it's all in how you define a public utility. In Virginia, we've got the carve-out, which I presume is fairly common in other states for self-generation. So long as you style it so it's behind the meter, so it looks like self-generation, or you style it for one of, as Baird pointed out, all the numerous exemptions you can have to the definition of a public utility, such as the landlord exemption. So we've got a lot of ways to dance around the utility must do everything, but it's not easy. And at least in Virginia, my sense is that you've got to have buy-in from the utility, which you don't always have. So you know, I'm hoping that and then we've also heard that this session, the utilities are going to try to push back, right? They think, you know, we've just now gotten some competitive renewable supply up and running. The utilities filed petitions this summer to block that, and they lost. And so now they said, well, we'll just go fix that at the state legislature, so, you know, we won't have that anymore. So it's going to be an interesting session. I hope that we will be advancing and not retreating, but it's just very much up in the air.
All right. We're probably going to run over a little bit as far as I can see, so anybody that wants to hang on after the hour, that would be fine if it does run over. So, Craig, go ahead.
Okay. This is Craig Lewis with the Clean Coalition, and I'll just start off by saying that I changed from being an independent to a Democrat a couple years ago because this impeached president was such a risk to our democracy, and all of his enablers are the same ilk. So thank goodness he is actually formally impeached now. Yeehaw. With that, I will say that the best example of a community microgrid, which is a microgrid that includes a broader grid area than just a single facility, is staging in the Humboldt County area of California. It's called the Redwood Coast Airport Microgrid Project, and referred to as RECAM, Redwood Coast Airport Microgrid. And that project is a partnership between the Humboldt State University, which is the prime on the grant that came from the California Energy Commission, and PG&E, which is the local utility, and the Redwood Coast Energy Authority, which is the community choice aggregator. The project is extremely interesting for all of the innovations it is bringing, and many of those are elements that have been referenced in this conversation so far, including the challenges that are being dealt with, hopefully dealt with, but definitely encountered, the challenges that are being encountered around the country. And I just read off a list of a few of those things, a few of those innovations that are happening in the RECAM. They include a comprehensive community microgrid, as I mentioned. There's about 20 customers at the end of a PG&E feeder. And out of those 20 customers, two of them are considered to be critical facilities, one of them being the airport and the other being a Coast Guard facility. There's going to be 2 megawatts of solar and 8 megawatt hours of energy storage that are DC coupled in front of the meter, so interconnected directly to the distribution grid. There's also some solar that's going to be interconnected behind the meter at the airport. There's a bank of 8 level 2 EV charging ports that will be configured behind the meter at one of the it'll be a dedicated meter, so those 8 EV chargers will be part of their own customer meter. So that's kind of just the physical layout. In terms of the operational layout, the utility, PG&E, will control the distribution grid portion of the community microgrid, both in terms of normal grid operations and in terms of grid outages. And by the way, I forgot to mention that there's going to be a grid isolation switch that isolates this, the whole end of this feeder that has 20 customers on it. So when there's a grid outage, that grid isolation switch will open, which means energy cannot flow across it, and these 20 customers and all of the distributed energy resources I mentioned will operate together seamlessly to provide very long duration resilience to all of the customers. It's not yet been contemplated. I'll get back to this point in a moment. So PG&E will operate the distribution side of the operations. The behind the meter assets will be configured to be controlled by customers during normal grid operations, but cede control to the utility, to PG&E, if necessary, for master control during community microgrid islanding operations. So when the grid goes down, obviously to keep the critical facilities operational, the energy and loads need to be in balance all the time in this community microgrid mode. And you need to be able to have some centralized control in that emergency community microgrid operational mode. And that will happen through the utility. A big part of this this initiative, this RECAM project, is to evaluate new tariffs and business models, and those tariffs, include
the fact that there's some free riders in this community microgrid mode. You've got 20 customers, only two of which are critical community facilities that you for sure want to keep on. The other 18, you know, from a community standpoint, don't really matter if they're on or not. The way this is configured initially, they're going to get to stay on for free. But that's not the way that community microgrids are going to proliferate broadly, right? There is an argument that the costs of keeping critical community facilities on that serve the communities, right, the broader communities, those costs could be rate-based and done so in a reasonable fashion that most people would agree is fair, right, because the whole community benefits, so the whole community can pay. But the private entities, for example, are not benefiting the whole community, and if they're going to get the benefits of indefinite renewables-driven backup power, then they should be on a tariff that they're paying for that extra enhanced level of service. So those tariffs and business models are a big part of this project. I sit on the technical advisory committee for the project, and I'm really looking forward to helping to bring this the Redwood Coast Airport microgrid to fruition, because we will suffer through a whole lot of policy and market mechanism innovations in order to get it to the finish line. So I'm going to leave my comments at that. And, you know, the Clean Coalition is working on a lot of other stuff, and I could talk about it. But for the purpose of being timely, I'll stop there and see where people want to take the conversation.
All right. As I said, we'll probably run over. So anybody have any comments?
You know, one, I have just some quick reactions. This is Larissa.
Larissa, can we let somebody else have? We have a lot of people on the call right now.
Sure.
We really need to open it for somebody.
I'm sorry.
I didn't know how.
I thought this was an internal group.
No. We got a bunch of people here. Well, it's internal, but there's a lot of internal people on the call.
Okay, so, I understand.
Yeah. So anybody has any comments
this
here?
This is Samuel Golding.
Go ahead,
I really appreciate the just the nature of this conversation, and Larissa. And
yeah,
record,
sorry, Sam. Sorry, there. It's been a while. Yes, Goldman.
That's right.
Sorry.
Yeah, Golding. Golding.
I'm sorry.
For the record, I'm a municipal libertarian in terms of my political preference. And it's interesting as everyone's kind of getting into this tumultuous time and grappling with the lack of a logical market structure and all the kind of the strategic maneuvering on the parts of the utilities and just kind of what to do about it. I wanted to say that I gave a webinar on the Municipal Sustainability Forum a few months ago that attempted to kind of survey a lot of this going on across the country, just kind of the political bottom-up wave demanding change and increasingly taking action in the broad public support across different political divides. How the utilities were responding to that and rolling out partnerships, updates on community choice, and a highlighting the ACE campaign, the Advanced Community Energy Paradigm developing in California, as a very holistic and sensible market structure, or industry structure, I should say, that could be broadly applicable if adapted across the country. I just want to emphasize what Larissa was saying. There is this wave of utility grid modernization going on across the country. Maybe over 20 states are evaluating these proposals, and at the core of them, she's right. They are seeking an expansion of their monopoly control. The narrative seems to be that the kind of market has failed, just generically, and so you're going to need to trust the utilities to manage all the distributed energy, or depending on the state, even to own the distributed energy. And in my view, it's we do need another wave of market restructuring across the country, but it's got to be a lot more holistic. It's got to align the nature of governance with the technology trends towards localism and decentralization. It's got to put in place the information and control, the grid mod technologies to make it all function. And it's got to appropriately define the roles of the utilities versus more innovative private sector firms versus communities and customer groups. And I think that ACE gets a lot of that right, just broad brushstrokes. So I'd encourage everyone to check that out.
You know, is there legislation brewing? Because I thought Lorenzo Christoph was one of those working on that.
Let's not go into that topic right now. That's another whole other conversation, and it's very important.
It was just yes or no. That's all I wanted.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks.
But it is, and they're focused on microgrids, by the way,
No, it's all important. I understand that, but we need to have a conversation on that itself because that's a lengthy topic. So anybody else that has not yet had a chance to speak, have any questions?
Yeah, this is Bob Perry. I think a lot of really important themes have been touched on in this conversation. You know, the idea of a Bill of Rights, emphasizing public purpose. I'm also working in the Advanced Community Energy, this working group, which is not to be confused with Advanced Community Energy. We may have to change the name, but the focus is to bring the utilities off of Mount Olympus, you know, to the table, and to get them to focus on being part of the community energy planning process. And I think that, you know, at this point in time, we're really, a lot of the issues that we're encountering involve framing, involve lexicon. I think, you know, we're getting to the point now where the term microgrid is starting to get twisted beyond recognition. I work with Clean Coalition, I collaborate with Clean Coalition. They're doing tremendous work down in the Santa Barbara Goleta area. They just reached a deal with the school district to start developing microgrids there. And these are the kind of things that, you know, it's wonderful that an organization like Clean Coalition is doing this thing, but this really ought to be part of, you know, local government. This needs to get baked into the general planning process. And so, you know, I'm hoping that we can start developing a more sophisticated framing and talking about maybe community grids, you know, as a reference to modernizing a distribution grid for a community or a series of communities, and then working on that basis. The other thing is I think one fundamental concept that needs to be explored is making sure that cost of delivery becomes an intrinsic part of an energy price and not to separate the two. And so that would incentivize, you know, locating generation closer to source so that, you know, those costs are reduced. I mean, I think we're really dealing right now at a kind of, as some people have pointed out, a very formative level. And I think it's going to be really important to developing a terms and a language that is accessible to most people, because most of the problems right now are political, you know. That's my comment.
Okay. I'd like to say one thing. I'd like to have anybody who has any more comments about co-ops, is where we started out, as far as a legal structure for microgrids. I'm kind of intrigued with that idea, and whether or not this could be in how many states, what are the parameters that would have to happen in order for that to move forward? Anybody comment on that, or Baird or somebody else?
Well, it is one of the interesting possibilities. It happens to work well under the statute in California. It doesn't work under the statute in New York because that only allows for rural co-ops. And, you know, you just have to look at it state by state, and I certainly haven't attempted a survey. But I think this focus on community action is really important. With one of my other hats on, I'm working on legislation for Delaware that would allow establishment of community energy authorities so that any town or county or city could basically set up an authority with the power to build things and finance things and do community solar and or other kinds of community energy projects and take advantage of community energy billing. So I think structures like that allow more flexibility to communities to do that sort of thing are going to be really critical.
And who is talking?
That was Baird Brown.
Thanks.
So anybody else
comment?
Have any
comments on that?
Yeah,
I'll just
sure.
make comment
ahead.
In terms of Baird. Yeah, and that's what we're trying to, you know, move forward in D.C., Distributed Energy Resource Authority, and I'd like to see this elsewhere as well. Another option, though, you know, the co-op is one type of form, but like Baird said, you got to look jurisdiction by jurisdiction. But I would hope, like I said, we could might be get a micro-municipalization approach in terms of legal institutionalization that would make it simpler for communities to set up some of the things that have been discussed here. And then again, like I said, striving for this new classification in terms of microgrid integrated energy services provider, because you have different, you know, going to the comment on the terms of lexicon, you know, we have load-serving entities, electricity, electrical service providers, utilities, but I think we need new classifications, and that's why we're trying to push for this you know, micro-energy services provider.
All right. Any other comments or questions?
Yeah,
I make
Bob
one?
Perry,
oh,
just,
sorry, go ahead.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Just
no,
one
go
quick.
Ahead.
Just one quick comment.
Yeah.
I think that
Introduce yourself, please.
Oh, this
introduce
is Bob Perry
please.
Again.
Yeah.
This is Bob Perry again. I'm a believer in performance-based regulations. I think that, you know, we need utilities need to be motivated to make things work as opposed to build things or to get ratepayers to build things. I think they need to be the focus needs to be on let's make this work, and to the extent you can, you will be rewarded for it. So that's my only last comment.
Amen, brother.
Yes, except, Sierra, could I make a quick comment? This will be very quick.
Sure. No, go ahead.
Two quick things. Performance-based, sorry to say, you know, you should look at what's happening in D.C., how this has been twisted in and out so that performance-based, is a instrument for extending natural monopoly and really mirroring how these instruments have been applied in the past. Just take a look at what comments PEPCO has filed in connection with its alternative rate making proposal. You would think we were operating like 20 years ago instead of the meaning you're giving to performance-based. I never dreamed that it could be so twisted. And then the other I wanted to mention with Craig, you know, that's great. I'm going to take a closer look. I've been following Humboldt a lot, but I'm going to put in a plug. I just hope that we have more inclusiveness And given the uncertainties and risks in the marketplace, we should be inclusive, and that's what's bothering me about the restrictive approaches, exclusionary approaches that so many of utilities are taking just in the name of their own economic viability. So I'll put in a plug in. I hope for more models along the Philadelphia Navy Yard, because they can do everything that, Craig, you described, but it's not being controlled by the utility. So even in terms of resilience, you don't have to have the utility actually controlling the microgrid controller. You can have the private entity or state-owned. Sorry.
Let me make a couple of important points here to your comments. One is the Navy Yard is all behind the meter, so that makes it a very different play.
Oh, correct, but it still is a good model, is what I'm saying. It's behind the meter for a reason.
We have the regulatory barriers.
It's an excellent model. I'm just saying I'm hoping that things will be more. It's not exclusively one or the other. I think what Humble's doing, you know, and the partnership is outstanding, but I that it won't be the only model, just what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, to that point, and I know we're out of time and I got to go, I got another call, but the last point I need to make is that the Redwood Coast Airport microgrid project, the front of meter assets are owned by the CCA, which is the Redwood Coast Energy Authority, RCEA. And that is intended to be a community choice energy agency, right? So it's supposed to be representing the community, and they will own the assets, but the assets that are on the utility side of the meter,
great,
have to be operated by the utility or whoever controls the distribution grid. They're not going to release the operation control of their wires.
Well, kudos to the efforts that have gone into, you know, putting all the different parties together in this. I hope in the future it gets simpler.
Amen.
Hear, hear.
Yeah, exactly. You got to do the first one before you can do the 100th and the 1,000th ones.
So I'd like to see everybody, some very important points were brought out during this call, and I'd like to see people think about the solutions for how to move forward. We understand a lot more about what the issues are. So maybe that's another call. Where can we go, and what do we need to do to make some of these things happen? So,
are we going to talk for a few minutes?
Yeah, we can. Anybody else have any comments here? I assume, I know Craig said he had to leave, but yeah, sure. Let's keep going.
Well, one of the most interesting aspects of this transfer
is this Samuel?
Samuel Goldberg.
Yeah, okay. Uh-huh.
Is that we know that there has to be a lot more integration of municipalities, communities, customer engagement within the power sector, planning and operations. And the local governments as a kind of channel for facilitating a lot of those interactions and relationship building is critical. And as you're all working on different ways to enable the authorities at that level, and I think D.C. was mentioned, possibly Maryland or Virginia. In my mind, one of the key challenges is not only delegating certain authorities down to the local level, but enabling them to actually make good decisions. In other words, this is kind of a massive institutional capacity building exercise that we're undertaking. So it's not just enough to say, okay, now you can, you know, build solar locally and charge everyone, but more like, how do you really enter into the right decisions and make the right investment choices so that, and have that all integrated with the broader sector and the grid mod and everything else? And that's why I like community choice, and certain utility partnerships actually are being designed to really educate staff and community stakeholders so that they essentially become a credible counterparty on the other side of the table from regulators and utilities and distributed energy aggregators so that they really understand what they're doing and can help change things and evolve things. So what the panelists' thoughts were on that level.
I certainly agree strongly
I'll mention
what you said.
What we're doing in connection in the proposed Delaware legislation that I talked about, Delaware already has a statewide agency called the Sustainable Energy Utility. And what we're really trying to do is help, you know, allow the local agencies to implement programs of the state agency, be their marketing arm, as well as taking on things on their own, and to, you know, get the state agency to be, you know, empowering and training and sharing. I mean, I think that's a great comment. I mean, that we need a sort of a structure of support for folks who aren't big enough and sophisticated enough to take it on all their own.
I just add, I think you need a good complement at the state level in terms of political leadership and the institutional push. I'm hoping, you know, National Governors Association has, recently in the past launched a, you know, smart community support initiative and to try to urge states to be more proactive in providing the resources, you know, technical assistance, enabling, you know, environment for communities. And I think that's important. And actually, I think California is an illustration of where a lot of that has been done already and could still serve as a model. There, I think, under this NGA, they've identified five states in their initial round that are supposed to provide leadership. But this is a crucial area for giving communities the necessary lift to empower them, like you said, to have the wherewithal and to be able to make informed decisions.
Anybody who has not yet had a chance to speak wants to add something?
Sierra,
okay.
David,
hey. No, sure. David, go ahead.
Yeah, this is all, as someone who's not as deep in the subject area as all of the speakers, this has all been fascinating. I would just like to emphasize the points that were just made and suggest that, you know, it's kind of like an all-hands-on-deck problem in terms of building capacity at the municipal level to do this. And, you know, there's a lot of different organizational points of entry into that vary in effectiveness from state to state. So I would endorse everything that was just said, but just say there's got to be more than that, because it's not a heavy lift to get the sort of the early adopters to get on board, but to really get the transformation that's necessary across the board, it's going to require a lot of capacity building. And I'll just mention that I don't know from state to state, but since I'm in a university, that there is a role that in, you know, through some university channels that could also be activated and brought to bear on trying to help folks through our, particularly through land-grant universities, to help through our outreach capacities to try and educate municipalities about this. I just want to add, I also had a, you know, to bring this down to a much narrower framework, I just wanted to ask a question to someone who's not nearly as educated in this arena as all those. And so I'm aware of, for example, in New York State, a whole bunch of campuses are just starting to work together across the state through the SUNY system and with some private universities and community colleges, and trying to form an aggregated renewable energy solution network that's essentially kind of like a demand aggregator. But I'm trying to understand what the potential might be for plugging into the issues and sort of coordinating with that, the potential for a group like that to sort of coordinate with the kinds of issues around microgrids that you all were focusing on, or is that too separate to sort of try and make that connection?
Well, that particular group was, among other things, This is Baird. That particular group was, among other things, trying to pull together a microgrid in, I forget whether it was North Manhattan or was within New York City in any event, around a bunch of medical facilities that were under their respective control. So they've got that on their mind as well. They were struggling there because there was simply no place to put a cogeneration facility in that dense environment. But absolutely. I mean, any way you can coordinate, collaborate, you know, we're talking with a group of municipalities outside of Philadelphia who aren't necessarily contiguous, aren't even all in one county, but they want to collectively form an enabling entity. Lots of ways to go about that.
And I agree strongly, too. In fact, well, the time wasn't right, but I was with the group a while back that tried to do it in California in terms of California state universities and connecting them. I mean, the technology actually is there, but it's something that will have to go stage by stage. So, as you said, starting here with the the distributed energy resources, the renewable energy solution network, and then you evolve it. But I think this interconnection of campuses and universities could be a powerful force to even change the political dynamics. The reason why it didn't in the end succeed, the effort that I was involved in out in California, was because there are a lot of politics between the universities, between the campuses, and you get caught in that, and you hope that there'll be something where, you know, in the greater good for all of them, they can all raise their level playing field, but they were so competing, and this was during the, you know, still economic doldrums, they were so competing for resources and attracting, you know, funding themselves, they couldn't get themselves together. But if you can get yourself together and do this kind of networking, boy, that would help weigh in this political balance. And the technologies are there. I mean, at the sophisticated level, as this would evolve, you've got the cloud technologies, you can network microgrids, et cetera, et cetera. So the key thing is, can the campuses, can these different entities within like SUNY, you know, work together for a greater good? It was that political that became the, and their own interest that became the greatest barrier in the, you know, effort that I was involved in.
Thank you. That's very interesting. It's also, one of the issues we have to deal with throughout this entire set of issues is you know, balancing, individual interests of individual entities and public interests, which I heard you all addressing in other ways as well. Thank you.
Okay.
Right.
Sierra? One more comment? Yes,
This is Richard Chase. I'm a
the
Princeton Municipal Light Department. We are a small muni in central Massachusetts, and we are abutting and part of a contiguous group of seven munis. Unfortunately, none of us are interconnected, and we are separated because of power delivery contracts from National Grid. But if we did connect and we use that interconnect, we would then shift the demand to a different muni who would then be penalized very severely for demand charges. So this is another of those things that unfortunately separates us, and we would love to have some good ideas. And I'm actually already working with the manager, and we're getting the other managers, we'll be talking with them and see if we can work that clause out of the new contract, which actually doesn't come up for another 5 years, but it'll take us that long to get there. So it's a
our condolences.
Different perspective, different problem.
Any thoughts?
keep trying, persevere. Very good idea, and I think you'll succeed. It's becoming more and more timely, but it's, again, how to marshal, you know, the political strategy, because they're probably good backers here on the utility side that in terms of the negotiation out and getting ready, but put all your pins, all your forces together, I say.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. Yes, all the community choice aggregation and everything, munis are sort of the precursor to all of that. We are attempting to move forward. It is tough because of contracts, and we have 78 road miles of poles and wires to maintain, and that's in a small residential customer base, which means we don't have a lot of revenue, quite frankly, which is to maintain all of that.
That's a topic I'd like to explore more. I'm very interested in munis and the possibilities there.
Was this New Jersey? You said Princeton?
No, Mass.
Massachusetts.
We're the one without the famous college.
Because I actually, of the two jurisdictions, to me, New Jersey is more amenable to what you're doing. Things are not going in the right direction in Massachusetts in terms of the political dynamics, in my view.
I would have to agree.
So, all right, guys, we're going to end the call. We have a lot of topics to explore in future calls, so this is not the end of it. Thanks for everybody for coming, and thanks to our panelists. Yet again, another interesting discussion, and I'll be sending out invitations to the calls for January, either today or tomorrow. Well, not tomorrow, today or Monday, and hope to see you all then.
Thanks. Great discussion. Happy holidays.
Yes, I was just going to say that. Everybody, happy holidays. You know, hope you get some chance to take a break. Do something fun.
We're counting on it.
Thanks. Thanks, everyone. Great conversation.
Thank you.
See you all.
All right. All right. Now.
Bye.